evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, August 22nd, 2017. South Sudanese communities in North America contribute money to help their brothers and sisters back home.
We were able to raise about 7,100, that's 7,100. One of the key contributors was the community here. We also did a campaign by going door to door and advocating to people about what is going on in South Sudan.
And traditional leaders in Torit say Imatong state authorities are doing nothing to prevent nighttime killings and lootings.
Criminal killing of innocent people, one will not appreciate. Because we in Torit here have declared no more return to war. But these people are trying to bring war here in order to destabilize the people or the Latuka people for that, or Torit town for that matter.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The government of South Sudan and the UN mission in the country had a standoff on Friday over where the UN-backed Regional Protection Force should be stationed in Juba. Lauren Sping is a peacekeeping advisor at the Center for Civilians in Conflict. She says the RPF will continue to face challenges in South Sudan. Sping says the Regional Protection Force is a temporary solution to the conflict.
Based on my research in South Sudan on the Regional Protection Force, it was clear that control of the airport was always going to be a contentious political issue. And that also it was going to be a key issue whether or not this Regional Protection Force was going to be allowed into the country with the right types of equipment to move quickly and to be able to really protect civilians around the city, around the capital, in case of any real deterioration in the security situation.
Looking at the history of the UN with this kind of force, is there any place where lessons could be learned from, where the Regional Protection Force or a force like that performed its mandate without difficulties?
The Regional Protection Force, it is not necessarily meant to be a rapid response force, but it is meant to bring in additional capacity and special capacity for the mission. I think the real added value of the Regional Protection Force should be in giving the peacekeeping mission more flexibility and capacity to shift other troops around where needed to protect civilians. And certainly there are other examples of regional troops contributing to peacekeeping missions in specialized ways. There's even the MINUSCO of the Force Intervention Brigade, but I think that can be a distraction because they do have very different mandates.
Every time I speak to people about these issues to do with the Regional Protection Force, and there are people who are saying, yeah, the UN did a great job in Eastern DRC with the M23, and they're also talking about the UN doing a great job in Yugoslavia. Were the forces in Eastern DRC and the ones in Yugoslavia some sort of a group that is sent to back the UN?
John, your point is definitely well taken, but I think what we should stress is that the Regional Protection Force and should be one extra tool for the mission. But what we really need to push is that all of the peacekeeping troops continue to respond to protection threats against civilians, that we empower and enable all of the troops on the ground under the UN peacekeeping mission to be responsible for protection of civilians. And I think the other big issue to keep in mind is that although the peacekeeping mission is the best tool that we have to protect civilians, really the only tool that we have to protect civilians in South Sudan now, it is really a short-term solution. So it can be a short-term way to improve protection for civilians, but in the long term, there definitely needs to be more diplomatic and international focus on the political solution to the conflict there.
That's Lauren Sping, a peacekeeping advisor at the Center for Civilians in Conflict. She focuses on South Sudan and the DRC. She was speaking with me from Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo earlier today. Traditional leaders from the Latuko community in Imatong State say they have lost hope in the government's ability to protect residents of Torit Town. They say at least five people, including the mayor's son, have been killed by men in uniform over the past 3 weeks. As we hear from Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit, the leaders are now turning to a local vigilante group for help.
Traditional leaders, landlords and residents held a community meeting over the weekend to talk about deteriorating security in the area. They say nighttime killings, robberies and gunfire have become all too common in recent weeks. And police and other security agencies have failed to apprehend the culprits or improve the security situation in the area. Susan Rocco, a resident of Torit's Lodikie neighborhood, says police officers rarely respond to distress calls from residents during an attack. Rocco says like yesterday, there were gunshots in their residence. Only them civilians were able to come out, but no police could come from the station to respond to the shooting. She questions what is their role towards civilians. She says this is worrying, and Rocco says that means the government is not caring about the lives of its citizens, as even as people are being shot dead. John Ohide, who resides in Torit's Iluhum area, says the police no longer care about upholding law and order.
We report to the police of this accident. Many times no one of the police can report even to go and investigate how the accident happened at Iluhum. Nobody come and ask us.
Torit traditional leader Lotuko King Vitali Ofuho says certain criminals are purposely looting property and killing people in order to cause chaos in Torit and other parts of Imatong estate.
So as a human being, you can't tolerate such kind of injustice in criminal killing of innocent people. One will not appreciate, because we in Torit here have declared no more return to war. But these people are trying to bring war here in order to destabilize the people or the Latuka people for that, or Torit town for that matter.
Landlord Thomas Omuduk is speaking in his native Orugo language, blames state security operatives for many of the killings.
You in the government, your people are killing my people. They go for operations, and when they get innocent civilians on the roads, they kill. Why? I'm saying, given that you are in our land, if you continue killing my innocent people, you will overturn with your curse and die.
Imatong Police Director Matthew Ochan says there are no enough police personnel to protect residents from criminal activity. He says police are unable to respond to calls in large part due all of the impassable roads in the area and because there are no enough police vehicles to go around.
We reach after 2 to 3 hours while the criminal is already not there. To recuse that situation soon, earlier, or before the time, it needs transport. But we have no any mobility.
Traditional leaders say they plan to mobilize a vigilant group called Monyomiji to end the killings since the police are not doing their job. Akim Paride Mamur, the leader of Monyomiji, says most residents live in fear.
In fact, today they say some people even hire guns from the organized sources. This could be weak soldiers who don't know what is the function of a gun. They hire out a gun, and the gun is used for robbery. But the worst part, at the end of the day, a person is dead. But the gun is returned to him.
At the community meeting, traditional leaders, landlords, and residents agreed that no one should be allowed to roam the town with guns, and all military personnel should be required to stay in their barracks unless they are called upon to deal with territorial security threats. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit.
South Sudanese in the diaspora have contributed money to feed hungry families in South Sudan. Martino Lako is the chairman of the South Sudanese community in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Lako says the South Sudanese living in Manitoba contributed $7,000 Canadian dollars for famine relief in South Sudan. He says the recent donations was handed to the UNHCR office in Canada.
When the media outlet starts talking about the famine in South Sudan, we, the South Sudanese here in Winnipeg, we felt that we have the obligation and responsibility to help our people back home. So we started a fundraising campaign that started like 2 months ago, and we went into three different avenues to collect funds. We engaged the youth, and they did a basketball tournament to raise money, and also on the community level, we had an ethnic dinner. We invited some of the guests, and the reason also was to collect money. And we also had a drum at the park, which was held at San Vital Park, and the event also was successful. We were able to collect some money. All those money will sum up and then were given to United Nations, which is the High Commissioner for Refugees, to help stop famine in South Sudan.
And how much did you raise? How many dollars are we talking about here that you raised in your several concerts and campaigns?
We were able to raise about 7,100. That's 7,100. And I also forget to mention that one of the key contributors was the community here. We also did a campaign by going door to door and advocating to people about what is going on in South Sudan. And we got a positive response. So people responded by making small donations towards this cause.
And how many South Sudanese are there in Winnipeg, Canada?
Well, we haven't done an estimate recently, but based on an estimate that has been done back 5 years ago, we have between 2,000 and 2,500.
Talk to me a little bit about how people coexist there. You know, since violence erupted in Juba, my experience in North America here in the United States here, people have divided themselves along their communities. And so it's difficult to really bring South Sudanese together to talk about a common good. What is the experience in Canada?
Well, actually, we are no different than any community in diaspora. What happened in South Sudan, of course, you know, is being reflected here in Winnipeg. But we, especially in the leadership of this community, we said, you know, let's put politics aside. For us to progress and prosper and be united, we have to forget about the politics that is going on in Juba. We have to live in harmony as one community. So this is the way that we went forward. Like, we did not give a chance, like, to people, especially who have, you know, affiliations to any of those political parties back home. We did not give them the chance, you know, to reflect what is happening in Juba here in Winnipeg.
What are other initiatives that your community in Winnipeg are doing to help people in South Sudan?
We have so many initiatives because we feel we in diaspora, especially we South Sudanese here in Winnipeg, we do have a role. Like, we can play a positive role, you know, to bring peace in South Sudan by engaging, you know, various level of government, various level of organizations, by advocating to them what's happening in South Sudan, and also by telling them, you know, to put the pressure on the government in South Sudan so they can work on a solution that will last and bring peace in South Sudan. One of the initiatives that we did is, like, engaging the community here and tell them, you know, we need to stand up. We need to engage, you know, the government. We need to engage the local organizations and tell them we have an issue in South Sudan, and this issue needs to be brought to an end. Because the people of South Sudan have suffered enough. They have suffered during the liberations, and then when they got their independence, the hope was really high that they're going to be living in harmony and peace, and the country will prosper. But all that just vanished in a blink of an eye 2 years ago when the conflict happened between, you know, the president and the vice president. But we still have hope. We still have hope that one day South Sudan will be living again in peace and harmony, and we will prosper.
That's Martino Laco, chairman of the South Sudanese community in Winnipeg, Manitoba. South Sudanese community in Manitoba bought a big hall in downtown Winnipeg, which serves to generate revenue for the community. Women in Torit say a saving and loan program that began about 6 months ago with help from non-governmental organization Care International is making life a little bit easier. The women who earn money by selling firewood or charcoal can borrow money from the savings and loan to pay their children's school fees and meet other family needs. Tito Justin has more for VOA from Juba.
Aduba! More than a dozen of women showed their appreciation for the village savings and loan program following a performance review last Wednesday with CARE International and the UN Food and Agriculture Organization in the Imatong State Capital Torit. Here is how the program works. Each woman contributes at least 50 South Sudanese pounds to the savings and loan or VSL program. Over the past 6 months, the women have saved nearly 30,000 South Sudanese pounds, the equivalent of $200. VSL member Lifia Itiara, a widow and mother of eight, seeks out a modest living selling firewood. Itiara finds it difficult to raise enough money to feed her children and pay their school fees. Speaking Arabic, she says, since the program began, she has been able to borrow money to pay school fees and buy food.
Even I, a poor woman, is able to benefit from it. If my children are sent home from school because of unpaid fees, I do come and borrow money to pay their tuition fees and use the rest of the money to buy food for us.
Victoria Egisa, a mother of twins, says before she joined the program, she could barely afford to buy food and medicine for her children, but that has changed. She says she recently borrowed more than 3,000 South Sudanese pounds to upgrade her two small businesses.
I had a local bakery and I brewed alcohol locally. So the money from the village savings helped my colleagues and I in different ways. For example, other women who borrowed money from the SCHEM have started to sell beans, others sell onions, and others sell green or okra in the market.
CARE International trained the women to manage their savings in order to become financially independent. Lydia Ruth Apido, a project assistant for CARE International, says most of the women benefiting from the project had houses looted or burned to the ground during fighting in the state. She says without the VSL program, most of them would have fled to refugee camps in neighboring countries, like hundreds of thousands of other South Sudanese women.
Some of them still want to go. But as someone was saying, because of their savings, they have some little hope that things will get better. It's really hard for them to get maybe school fees, food for the kids. Sometimes there's sickness, and they keep running to us anytime they need help.
Karima Gisaha heads the Ituba Village Savings and Loan Program in Torit. Speaking Arabic, Gisaha says many members are widows, while others lost most of their properties during the conflict.
We use the money and the SCHEM loans to start business. Some of the group members left the SCHEM and are now doing their independent business. We still want such women who are now financially independent to help us in future, let them promote our group.
The Village Saving and Loan Project is the first of its kind by CARE International and UN FAO to help women live independent in Torit after fighting spread out in the state last year. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, more South Sudanese children are taking care of themselves in northern Uganda. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is there anything you completed simply because you were told you couldn't?
Actually, in my life, all my plans, they are all going on well. There's nothing which has defeated me, and people can say, for you, you are just doing this one, you cannot manage. Actually, I've not gone through that experience.
Yeah, actually, there is. When I was in secondary school, people were telling me that I should not take science section. They say that I cannot make it. So I decided to take it, and I did it. I did science section, and it was very okay.
Yes, actually, when I started my primary school, some of my friends were telling me that I will never get number one. But because I see it was a challenge, but I try my level best. After all, I was number one.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday Health segment, and today we are talking about U.S. spending on world health programs. U.S. President Donald Trump has proposed a big cuts in spending on global health research that could affect work that is being done to end malaria and AIDS, as well as programs that protects against the spread of other infectious disease. The president's budget proposal is a wish list, but some see it as a disturbing trend. VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
When the Ebola crisis erupted in 2014, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention sent staff to help West African countries contain the pandemic. The National Institutes of Health funded research and supported pharmaceutical giants to produce a vaccine that would not be profitable. NIH has also been instrumental in the fight against AIDS and malaria. AIDS deaths are now close to half of what they were in 2005, according to the UN AIDS Agency, and researchers seem to be closing in on a malaria vaccine. President Trump's proposed 2018 budget calls for an 18% funding cut for NIH and a 17% cut for the CDC. Stephen Morrison heads the Global Health Policy Center at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
If these cuts as proposed were enacted, it would have severe impact on health security.
And it's far cheaper to be ready for a disease outbreak than to fight one once it starts, notes Jamie Bay Nishi with the Global Health Technologies Coalition.
The National Academy of Medicine put out a report estimating that responding to a pandemic threat costs $60 billion, but ongoing investment in preventative research to try and mitigate against a future threat is $1 billion per year.
Nishi says U.S. investments have produced malaria drugs that have saved 750,000 lives and an inexpensive meningitis vaccine that has prevented nearly 400,000 deaths. In addition, large pharmaceutical companies like Johnson & Johnson need the government to back research, especially for drugs for low-income countries. Jamie Taylor is with Johnson & Johnson.
We cannot do it on our own, and that's definitive.
Morrison says the president's budget request isn't a done deal.
He's not going to get all that he wants, but he's going to get something.
The main problem, as Morrison and others see it, is if budget cuts continue, the U.S. will lose its position as a world leader in medical research, and the world will be more vulnerable to the spread of infectious disease. Elizabeth Cameron from the Nuclear Threat Initiative says bioterrorism could become a greater risk to the U.S.
Absolutely vital that we get to a point where we're able to respond to any disease threat that comes our way, no matter how it comes our way.
And finally, Nishi argues that U.S. research and development creates jobs that would be lost by budget cuts.
U.S. government investments in global health R&D not only save millions of lives around the world, but they support U.S. jobs, U.S. economy, and U.S. health security.
But the Secretary of the Health and Human Services Department, Dr. Tom Price, says if both agencies cut administrative costs, they won't lose programs.
And I think what the budget is trying to do is to, being the first step in this process, is trying to bring focus to the kinds of things that we ought to be able to do to get a greater, bigger bang for our buck.
Congress will tackle these issues when the lawmakers return from their summer recess in September. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
From Washington, we move to Uganda, where hundreds of South Sudanese children who separated from their parents while fleeing fighting in South Sudan last year say they are yet to reunite with their loved ones. Simon Peter Apiku has the story for VOA from Adjumani in northern Uganda.
When fighting erupted in Juba a year ago last July between government soldiers and troops loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar, violence quickly spread to Imatong State's Pagiri County. 16-year-old Sekina Christine was living with her 16-year-old stepsister and an 18-year-old brother in Kerepe Village. Sekina's siblings escaped from their village, but their mother remained in Imule Town because she was running a business. Sekina says she's been looking after her siblings at the Agodzo refugee settlement in Adjumani district ever since they arrived in Uganda last year.
My father died in 2005.
but my mother is around in Inumule. She refused to come here.
16-year-old Irene Forney says she parted ways with her mother in the confusion and chaos that followed the arrival of government soldiers at Pagari in July 2016. Irene says Uganda's Red Cross Society tried in vain to find her mother, whom she has not heard from since fleeing South Sudan's conflict. And Irene says she has no idea what happened to her two younger brothers who were in Juba when the fighting erupted. Irene says she has been on her own at the Agodzo camp in northern Uganda for more than a year now.
I'm just alone, nobody.
Save the Children and the Lutheran World Federation are trying to help hundreds of unaccompanied children like Irene and Sekina by constructing small houses and enrolling the refugee children in school. Sekina, her stepsister, her brother, and Irene attend the Agodzo South Primary School. Unlike Sekina and Irene, who only live with their siblings, Eunice and her sister are lucky. A woman in the camp who sympathized with the children invited them to stay with her family. Sekina says the food rations they receive are not enough to last the entire month, so they must find other means to buy food and school materials.
We sell charcoal and we pay our school fee, we'll eat.
Eimani says she must also work hard to earn some money because her scholarship covers only tuition and a little food.
They are paying the school fee plus the feeding fee, and then they bought for us the uniform. That is what they are giving for us, but soap plus the book plus pen, they are not giving it.
Afor Grace is a foster parent at the Agodzo camp. Grace says she adopted three children aged 11, 9 and 7, whom she found wandering around the settlement.
Say, where is your mommy? They said they don't know their mommy. And then I decided to ask the other one, the elder one, where is your father? They say their father is, they don't know even the father is alive because they were, as the war started, they just ran like that. Then they followed the other people, and then they came. Then I decided to take care of the children.
Grace, who has four children of her own, says in a few weeks' time she was able to track down an elderly relative of the children in Yumbe District's West Nile region. But the relative said he could not take care of the children. UNHCR spokesman in Uganda Charlie Yaxley says nearly two-thirds of the South Sudanese refugee population is children under the age of 18, and that includes orphans and unaccompanied minors. He says supporting these children presents a huge challenge to the UN Refugee Agency and its partners. Yaxley says the UNHCR's budget has so far received only 20% of its $674 million for 2017. He adds the UNHCR and its partners can only assist 10% of identified orphans and households headed by children with basic items like food, shelter, and bed mattresses. For VOA News, I'm Simon Peter Piku in Adzumani.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Morina Opidri by Lanson Lee. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being here. We would like to hear what you think about our show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. Find us on our Facebook page, South Sudan in Focus. We hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Peleyo tamongole di utia tamuyole di utia lini mu pele di utia tamongole di utia hopi madiole mandre nyotea hopi madiole mandowe yesu madiole mandre nyotea yesu madiole mandowe hopi madini lelendrowe 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 hopi yesu ni lelendrowe lelendrowe.